and said, "Tell me about your shop."
"Oh, it was a beautiful place," Luigi said. "Just off the Piazza di Spagna, at the bottom of the Spanish Steps. Do you know the area?"
"I have been to the Spanish Steps," Pino said, pleased that Luigi had not hesitated to follow him. "That's a fine neighborhood, many elegant stores."
"A wonderful place for business," Luigi said.
Pino walked through the back of the V. He and the cigar smoker were on opposite sides of the cleft now. If Luigi was ever going to look down, it was now. When Pino saw Luigi turn his head to do just that, he said, "Describe your store to me." Luigi's eyes found Pino's.
"Oil-rubbed wood floors and counters," he said, chuckling and taking the turn with ease. "Tufted leather chairs, and an octagonal humidor that my late wife and I designed ourselves."
"I bet the store smelled good."
"The best. I had cigars and tobaccos from all over the world in there, and dried lavender, mints, and sensen, and fine brandy for my favorite customers. I had so many good and loyal customers. They were my friends, really. The shop was like a club until quite recently. Even the filthy Germans came in to buy."
They were all through the cleft and climbing diagonally toward the rim again. "Tell me about your wife," Pino said. There was a brief silence behind him, and he felt resistance on the rope before Luigi said,
"My Ruth was the most beautiful woman I've ever known. We met at temple when we were 12. Why she chose me, I'll never know, but she did. It turned out we couldn't have kids, but we spent 20 wonderful years together before she just got sick one day, and sicker the next, and the next. The doctors said her digestive system had reversed, and they couldn't stop it from poisoning her to death."
Pino flashed with a pang on Mrs. Beltramini, and wondered how she was, how Carletto was, and his father. "I'm sorry," Pino said, climbing up over the rim.
"It's been 6 years," Luigi said, as Pino helped him up and then the couple. "And not an hour goes by when I don't think of her."
Pino clapped the cigar trader on the back and grinned. "You did it. We're at the top."
"What?"
Luigi said, gazing around in wonder.
"That's it?"
"That's it," Pino said.
"That wasn't so bad,"
Luigi said, and looked to the sky with relief.
"Told you. We can rest ahead. There's something I want you to see first."
He led them to where they could look over the back side of the Gropera. "Welcome to Val di Lei," he said. The slope of the alpine valley there was gentle compared to the front side of the mountain and was covered with low, wind-stunted mountain shrubs, with leaves turning rust, orange, and yellow. Far down the valley, they could see its namesake. Fewer than 200 meters wide and perhaps 800 long, the alpine lake ran north-south toward that triangle of woods Father Ray had described. The lake's surface was silver-blue normally, but that day it reflected and radiated the flaming colors of fall. Beyond the lake, a bulwark of stone rose and ran off to the south a long way toward Passo Angeloga and the stone cairn where Pino had turned around his first day of training. They began to hike down along a game path that ran along a creek, fed by glaciated snow still clinging to the highest peaks.
"I did it," Pino thought, feeling happy and satisfied. "They listened to me, and I got them over the Gropera."
"I've never been anywhere more beautiful than this," Maria said when they reached the lake. "It feels incredible. It feels like
freedom, Ricardo said. A moment to cherish, Luigi said.
Are we in Switzerland already?
Maria asked.
Almost, Pino said.
We go into the woods there a ways to reach the border.
Pino had never been beyond the lake, so he walked to the woods with some apprehension. But he remembered Father Ray's description of where he'd find the path, and he soon located it. The dense grove of fir and spruce was almost like a maze. The air was cooler, and the ground softer. They'd been climbing for close to 6.5 hours, but no one looked tired. Pino's heart beat a little faster at the thought that he'd led these people to Switzerland. He'd helped them escape the... A big bearded man stepped out from behind a tree 3 meters ahead. He pointed a double-barreled shotgun at Pino's face.
Chapter 9 1 Petrified, Pino threw up his hands. So did his 3 charges.
Please, Pino began.
Over the barrel of the gun, the man snarled.
Who sent you?
Father,
Pino stuttered.
Father Ray.
A long moment passed as the man's eyes flitted from Pino to the others. Then he lowered the gun.
We must be careful these days, yes?
Pino dropped his hands, feeling sick and weak on his feet. Icy sweat dripped down his spine. He'd never had a gun pointed at him before.
Luigi said,
You will help us now, Signore?
My name is Bergstrom, the man said. I'll take you from here.
Where?
Maria asked fretfully.
Down through the Emmett Pass to the Swiss village of Innerferrera, Bergstrom said. You'll be safe, and we can figure out your next journey from there.
Bergstrom nodded to Pino.
Give my best to Father Ray.
I will, Pino promised, and then turned to his 3 companions.
Good luck.
Maria hugged him. Ricardo shook his hand. From his pocket, Luigi pulled a small metal tube with a screw cap. He handed it to Pino.
It's Cuban, he said.
I can't take it. Luigi looked insulted.
You don't think I know how you got me up that last bit? A fine cigar like this is hard to come by, and I don't give it away lightly.
Thank you, Signore, Pino said, smiling and taking the cigar.
Bergstrom said to Pino,
Your safety depends on staying unseen. Be careful before you leave the forest. Study the hillsides and the valley before you move on.
I will.
We go then,
Bergstrom said, turning away. Luigi patted Pino on the back and followed. Ricardo smiled at him.
Maria said, Have a good life, Pino.
And you.
I hope we have no climbing to do, he heard Luigi say to Bergstrom as they disappeared into the trees. A climb down is not a climb up, Bergstrom replied.
After that, all Pino could make out was the snap of a branch, a rock tumbling, and then nothing but the wind through the firs. Though happy, he felt oddly and acutely alone when he turned around and walked back into Italy. Pino did as Bergstrom had instructed. He stopped and stood inside the tree line to study the valley and the heights above it. When he was sure as he could be that no one was watching, he set out once again. By his watch, it was nearly noon. He'd been on the move for nearly 9 hours, and he was tired. Father Ray had foreseen his fatigue and told him not to try to make the trip back that day. Instead, his orders were to climb southwest to an old shepherd's hut, one of several on the mountain, and spend the night. Pino would return to Casa Alpina via Medesimo in the morning. As Pino hiked south through Val d'Ilay, he felt good and satisfied. They'd done it. Father Ray and everyone else who'd helped get the refugees to Casa Alpina. As a team, they'd all saved three people from death. They'd fought back against the Nazis in secret, and they'd won. To his surprise, the emotions that flooded through him made him feel stronger, refreshed. He decided not to spend the night in the hut, but to push on to Madesimo, to sleep at the inn and see Alberto Ascari. When he was almost to the ridge, Pino stopped to rest his legs and eat again. 2. When he was finished, he looked back at Val d'Ilay and noticed four tiny figures moving south along the stone outcropping above the lake. Pino shaded his eyes, trying to see them better. He couldn't tell anything about them at first, but then made out that they were all carrying rifles. Pino got a sickening feeling in his stomach. Had they seen him go into the forest with three people and come out alone? Were they Germans? Why were they out in the middle of nowhere? Pino had no answers to the questions, which continued to trouble him after the four men disappeared from view. He made his way down the goat trails and through the alpine meadows to Madesimo. It was nearly 4 in the afternoon when he walked into the village. A group of boys, including his little friend Nico, the innkeeper's son, was at play not far from the inn. Pino was about to enter and inquire about a room when he noticed Alberto Ascari hurrying toward him, clearly upset. "A band of partisans was here last night," Ascari said. "They said they were fighting the Nazis, but they were asking about Jews." "Jews?" Pino said, and looked away, seeing Nico squat in the high grass and pick up what, at a distance of nearly 40 meters, looked like a large egg. "What did you say to them?" "We told them there were no Jews here. Why do you think that they..." Nico held the egg out to show his friends. The egg became a flash of fire and light a split second before the force of the explosion hit Pino like a mule's kick. He almost fell, but regained his balance drunkenly, disoriented and unsure what had happened. Even with his ears ringing, he could hear the children's screams. Pino lurched toward them. The boys who had been closest to Nico were down. One had lost a hand. The other's eyes were bloody sockets. Part of Nico's face was gone, and most of his right arm. Blood pooled and spattered all around the little boy. Hysterical, Pino scooped Nico up, seeing the little boy's eyes roll back in his head, and raced him toward the inn and his mother and father, who'd burst out the front door. The boy started convulsing.
"No!"
Nico's mother screamed. She took her son. He convulsed again and then sagged dead in her arms.
"No, Nico! Nico!"
In a daze of disbelief and horror, Pino watched Nico's sobbing mother go to her knees, lay her son's body on the ground, and cover it with her own, as if she were leaning over his crib when he'd been a baby. For many moments, Pino just stood there, numb, watching her grieve. Glancing down, he saw he was smeared in blood. He looked around and noticed villagers rushing to treat the other children, and the innkeeper staring forlornly at his wife and dead son.
"I'm sorry," Pino whimpered. "I couldn't save him."
Mr. Conte said dully, "You didn't do this, Pino. Those partisans last night must have..."
"But who would leave a grenade where..."
He shook his head and choked.
"Can you get Father Ray? He needs to bless my Nico's body."
Even though he'd been up since the dead of night and had covered nearly 23 kilometers in steep terrain, Pino was determined to run the entire way, as if his feet and speed alone could separate him from the brutality of what he had just witnessed. Halfway up the trail, though, the smell of blood on his clothes, and the vivid memories of Nico boasting about being a better skier than Pino, and the fiery flash that took the little boy were too much for him. Pino stopped, bent over, and vomited his insides out. Weeping, he staggered the rest of the way to Motta, as daylight faded to dusk. 3. When he reached Casa Alpina, Pino was ashen, wrung out. Father Ray was shocked when Pino came into the empty dining room.
"I told you to stay,"
Father Ray began, then saw Pino's bloody clothes and struggled to his feet.
"What's happened? Are you all right?"
"No, Father,"
Pino said, starting to cry again, and not caring as he told the priest what had happened.
"Why would someone do that? Leave a grenade?"
"I have no idea," Father Ray said grimly as he went for his jacket.
"What about our friends you guided?"
The memory of Luigi, Ricardo, and Maria disappearing into the woods seemed like ages ago.
"I left them with Mr. Bergstrom."
The priest put on his coat and grabbed his cane.
"That is a blessing, then. Something to be grateful for."
Pino told him about seeing the four men with rifles.
"But they didn't see you?"
"I don't think so," Pino said. Father Ray reached up and put his hand on Pino's shoulder.
"You did well, then. You did the right thing."
The priest left. Pino sat on a bench at an empty table in the dining room. He closed his eyes and hung his head, seeing Nico's missing face and arm, and the boy who'd been blinded, and then the dead girl with the missing arm from the night of the first bombardment. He couldn't get rid of those images, no matter how hard he tried. They just kept repeating, until he felt as if he were going crazy.
"Pino?" Mimo said sometime later.
"You okay?" Pino opened his eyes, to find his brother crouched at his side. Mimo said, "Someone said the innkeeper's little boy died, and two other boys might."
"I saw it," Pino said, and started to cry again. "I held him."
His brother seemed frozen by the sight of his tears, but then said, "Come on, Pino. Let's get you cleaned up and to bed. The younger boys shouldn't see you like this. They look up to you." Mimo helped him to his feet and down the hall to the shower room. He stripped his clothes and then sat a long time in the lukewarm water, mindlessly scrubbing Nico's blood off his hands and face. It didn't seem real. Except it was. Father Ray gently shook him awake around 10 the next morning. For a few moments, Pino had no idea where he was. Then it all came back with such force that it took his breath away all over again.
"How are the Contes?"
The priest turned grim. "It's a terrible blow for any parent to lose a child under any circumstances. But like that..."
"He was such a funny little kid," Pino said bitterly. "It's not fair."
"It's a tragedy," Father Ray said. "The other two boys will live, but they'll never be the same." They shared a long silence.
"What do we do, Father?"
"We have faith, Pino. We have faith and continue to do what is right. I got word in Madesimo that we will have two new travelers for dinner tonight. I want you to rest today. I'll need you to guide them in the morning."
4. It became a pattern over the course of the following weeks. Every few days, 2, 3, or sometimes 4 travelers would ring the bell at Casa Alpina. Pino would lead them out in the wee hours of the morning, climbing by what light the moon offered, and using the carbide miner's lamp only during cloud cover and the dark of the moon. On these trips, after handing over his charges to Bergstrom, he went to the shepherd's hut. It was a crude affair with a stacked stone foundation dug into the side of the slope, a sod roof supported by logs, and a door that swung on leather hinges. There was a straw mattress and a wood stove with split wood and a hatchet. Those nights in the hut, as he stoked the fire, Pino felt lonely. He tried to summon up memories of Anna to comfort him more than once, but all he could recall was the squall of the trolley as it blocked her from his view. His thoughts would then turn abstract, to girls and to love. He hoped he'd have both in his life. He wondered what his girl would be like, and whether she would adore the mountains as he did, and whether she skied, and 100 other questions with maddeningly unknowable answers. In early November, Pino led the escape of a British Royal Air Force pilot, shot down during a bombing raid on Genoa. A week later, he helped a second downed pilot to reach Mr. Bergstrom. And almost every day, more Jews came to Casa Alpina. In the dark days of December 1943, Father Ray grew worried because of the increased number of Nazi patrols going up and down the Splugen Pass Road.
"They're becoming suspicious," he told Pino. "The Germans haven't found many of the Jews. The Nazis know they're being helped."
"Alberto Ascari says there have been atrocities, Father," Pino said. "The Nazis have killed priests helping Jews. They've pulled them right off the altar while they were saying Mass."
"We have heard that too," the priest said. "But we can't stop loving our fellow man, Pino, because we're frightened. If we lose love, all is lost. We just have to get smarter."
The next day, Father Ray and a priest in Campo Dolcino came up with an ingenious plan. They decided to use watchers to track the Nazi patrols on the Splugen Pass Road, and they improvised a communications system. In the chapel behind Casa Alpina, there was a catwalk around the interior of the steeple. From it, through shutters that opened on the flank of the tower, the boys could see the upper floor of the rectory 1,500 meters below in Campo Dolcino, and one window in particular. The shade was drawn in that window when the Germans were patrolling the Splugen. If the shade was up during the day, or a lantern shone there at night, refugees could be safely taken up the mountain to Molta in ox carts, buried under piles of hay, to avoid detection. When it became clear that Pino could not lead every Jew, downed pilot, or political refugee who came to Casa Alpina seeking a way to freedom, he began to teach the routes to several of the other older boys, including Mimo. Heavy snowfall held off until mid-December of 1943. But then it turned cold, and the skies began to dump, hard and often. Feathery powder snow built up in the chutes and bowls of the upper Gropera, making them avalanche-prone, which soon shut down the preferred northern route to Val d'Ilay and the Emmett Pass into Switzerland. Because many of the refugees had never faced cold, snowy conditions before, nor had the faintest idea about mountain climbing, Father Ray risked sending Pino, Mimo, and the other guides along the easy southern route over the Angel's Step. They started carrying skis with climbing skins to speed the return trip. The brothers left Casa Alpina the third week of December and joined their family in Rapallo to celebrate Christmas and to wonder whether the war would ever be over. The Lellas had all hoped the Allies would have freed Italy by now, but the Germans' so-called Gustav line of pillboxes, tank traps, and other fortifications was holding from the town of Monte Cassino east to the Adriatic Sea. Allied progress had ground to a halt. 5. On Pino and Mimo's way back to the Alps, the train passed through Milan. parts of the city they barely recognized. When Pino reached Casa Alpina this time, he was more than happy to be spending his winter in the Alps. He and Mimo loved to ski, and they were experts at it by then. They used skins to climb the slopes above the school and schust in the fresh deep powder that had fallen during their brief time away. Both boys adored the speed and thrill of skiing, but it meant more to Pino than adventure. Swooping down the mountain was the closest he'd ever come to flying. He was a bird on skis. It warmed his soul. It set him free in a way nothing else did. Pino would fall asleep tired, achy, and happy, and wanting to do it all again tomorrow. Alberto Ascari and his friend, Titiana, decided to host a New Year's Eve party at the Conte's Inn in Madesimo. There had been a lull in the number of refugees during the holiday week, and Father Ray granted Pino's request to attend the bash. Excited, Pino oiled his climbing boots, put on his best clothes, and walked down to Madesimo in lightly falling snow that made everything look magical and new. Ascari and Titiana were putting the finishing touches on the decorations when Pino arrived. He spent time with the Contes, who, though still grieving for their son, were glad for the business and distraction the party afforded. And what a party it was! There were twice as many young ladies present as men, and Pino had a full dance card for much of the evening. The food was wonderful, speck ham and gnocchi, and polenta with fresh Montasio cheese, and roe deer venison with dried tomatoes and pumpkin seeds. The wine and beer flowed. Later in the evening, Pino was slow dancing with Frederica and realized he hadn't once thought of Anna. He was wondering if the night would end perfectly, with a kiss from Frederica, when the door to the inn flew open. Four men with old rifles and shotguns walked in. They were shabbily dressed with filthy red scarves around their necks. Their gaunt cheeks were red from the cold, and their sunken eyes put Pino in mind of feral dogs he'd seen after the bombardments began, scavenging for any scraps they could find.
"We are partisans fighting to free Italy from the Germans," one of them announced, and then licked the left inside corner of his lips. "We need donations to continue the fight."
Taller than the others, he wore a knit wool cap that he pulled off and waved at the partygoers. No one moved.
"You bastards!" Mr. Conte roared. "You killed my son!"
He charged at the leader, who clubbed the innkeeper with the butt of his rifle and knocked him to the floor.
"We did no such thing," he said. "You did, Tito," Conte said, lying on the ground, bleeding from his head. "You or one of your men left a grenade. My son picked it up, thought it was a toy. He's dead. Another boy has been blinded. Another lost his hand."
"Like I said," Tito said, "we don't know a thing about it. Donations, per favore."
He raised his rifle and fired a bullet through the ceiling, which provoked the men at the party to turn out their pockets and the young ladies to open their purses. Pino fingered a 10-lira note from his pocket and held it out. Tito snatched it and then stopped to look him up and down.
"Nice clothes," he said. "Turn out your pockets."
Pino didn't move a muscle. Tito said,
"Do it, or we'll strip you naked."
Pino wanted to punch him, but he pulled out a leather and magnet money clip his Uncle Albert designed and removed a wad of lira, which he held out to Tito. Tito whistled and snatched the money. Then he stepped closer and studied Pino, exuding a threat that was as strong as his foul body odor and breath.
"I know you," he said.
"No, you don't."
"Yes, I do,"
Tito said again, his face close to Pino's.
I've seen you in my binoculars. I've seen you climbing over Paso Angeloga and across the Emmet with many strangers.
Pino said nothing. Tito smiled and then licked the corner of his lips.
What the Nazis would give to know about you.
I thought you were fighting the Germans, Pino said. Or was that just an excuse to rob a party? Tito hit Pino in the gut with the butt of his rifle, knocking him to the ground.
Stay off those passes, kid, Tito said. You tell the priest the same thing. Angel Step, the Emmet, they're ours. You understand?
Pino lay there gasping for air and refusing to reply. Tito kicked him.
Understand?
Pino nodded, which pleased Tito, who studied him.
Nice boots, he said at last. What size?
Pino grunted an answer.
Couple pairs of warm socks, they'll work just fine. Take them off. They're the only boots I have. You can take them off alive, or I can take them off you dead. Your choice.
Humiliated and hating the man, but not wanting to die, Pino unlaced the boots and pulled them off. When he glanced at Frederica, she reddened and looked away, making Pino feel like he was doing something cowardly when he handed Tito the boots.
That money clip, too,
Tito said, snapping his fingers twice. My uncle made that for me, Pino complained.
Tell him to make you another. Tell him it's for a good cause.
Sullen, Pino dug in his pocket and got out the money clip. He flipped it at Tito. Tito snagged it out of the air.
Smart boy.
He nodded to his men. They grabbed food from the buffet, stuffing it into their pockets and packs before leaving.
Stay off the Emmet,
Tito said again, and they were gone. 6. When the door shut behind them, Pino wanted to put his fist through a wall. Mrs. Conte had rushed to her husband's side and was pressing a cloth to his wound.
Are you all right? Pino asked.
I'll live, the innkeeper said. I should have gotten my gun. Shot them all.
Who was he, the partisan? You said Tito?
Yes, Tito, from over Soste way. But he's no partisan. He's just a crook and a smuggler from a long line of crooks and smugglers. And now a murderer. I'm getting my boots and my money clip back.
Mrs. Conte shook her head and said,
Tito's cunning and dangerous. You'll stay away from him if you know what's good for you, Pino.
Pino felt disgusted with himself for not standing up to Tito. He couldn't stay at the party any longer. It was over for him. He tried to borrow some boots or shoes, but no one had his large size. In the end, he took wool socks and low rubber overshoes from the innkeeper and flailed through the storm back to Casa Alpina. When he'd finished telling Father Ray what Tito had done, and that he or one of his men had killed Nico and maimed the children, the priest said,
You chose the greater good, Pino.
How come I don't feel good about it? Pino said, still angry. And he said to tell you to stay off Angel's Step and the Emmet.
Did he now? Father Ray said, turning stony. Well, I'm sorry, but that we will not do.
Chapter 10 1 A meter of snow blanketed the mountains above Casa Alpina on New Year's Day, followed by a day's break, and then another meter fell. There was so much snow, it took until the second week of January before the escapes could resume. After locating replacement boots, Pino and his brother began leading Jews, downed pilots, and other refugees in groups as large as 8. Despite Tito's warnings about using Paso Angeloga,
They stuck to the more gradual southern way to Val d'Ilay by constantly changing the days and times they'd go, and then skiing back along the northern route to Madesimo. This system worked well into early February 1944. When the lantern was shining in the upper window of the Campo Dolcino rectory, a steady stream of refugees hiding under hay in ox carts moved up through Madesimo to Casa Alpina, and then followed Pino or one of the other boys over the Gropera into Switzerland. Reaching the shepherd's hut in a daze early in the month, Pino found a note nailed to the wall of the hut. It read, "Last warning." Pino threw the note in the stove and used it to light the wood stacked inside. He adjusted the damper and went outside to chop more wood. He hoped Tito was out there somewhere in the vast alpine terrain around him, looking through his binoculars and seeing Pino refuse to... A thunderous explosion blew open the hut door. Pino dove into the snow. He lay there shaking with fear for several minutes before he could build up the courage to look inside. The stove was barely recognizable. The force of the bomb, or grenade, or whatever had been put in the stove, had blown the firebox apart, throwing shards of heated metal that chipped the stone foundation and stuck like tiny knives in the beams and woodwork. Glowing wood embers burned holes in his pack and lit the straw bed afire. He dragged them both into the snow and got them snuffed out, feeling completely exposed. If Tito was willing to put a bomb in the hut's stove, he was willing to shoot him. Pino fought off the sense that someone was aiming at him as he put his skis back on, hoisted his pack onto his shoulders, and picked up his ski poles. The hut was no longer a refuge, and the southern route was no longer a viable option. "There's only one way left," Pino told Father Ray that evening by the fire, as the boys and several new visitors ate another of Brother Bormio's masterpieces. "With the snow piling up, it was inevitable that you would have to use it at some point," the priest replied. "The spine of the ridge will be blown free of snow, and the footing will be the best on the mountain. You'll go again with Mimo the day after tomorrow. Teach him the way." Pino flashed on the chimney, the catwalk, and the cable traverse below the Gropera's crag, and was instantly full of doubt. Any misstep up there in these conditions meant death. Father Ray gestured at the visitors and said, "You'll take that young family and the woman with the violin case. She used to play at La Scala." 2. Pino twisted around, puzzled, before recognizing the violinist he'd seen at his parents' party the night of the first bombardment. He knew she was in her late 30s or early 40s, but she looked like she'd aged and was ill. What was her name? He put thoughts of the Gropera out of his mind, got Mimo, and they walked over to her. "Remember us?" Pino said. The violinist seemed not to recognize them. "Our parents are Portia and Michele Lella," Pino said. "You went to a party at our old apartment on Via Monte Napoleone." Mimo said, "And you yelled at me in front of La Scala for being a little boy who couldn't see what was happening all around me. You were right." A slow smile built on her face. "That seems so long ago." "Are you okay?" Pino asked. "Just a little queasy in the stomach," she said. "The altitude. I don't think I've ever been this high up. Father Ray says I will get used to it in a day or so." "What shall we call you?" Mimo asked. "What do your papers say?" "Elena. Elena Napolitano." Pino noticed the wedding ring she wore. "Is your husband here, Mrs. Napolitano?" She looked ready to cry, hugged her belly, and choked. "He made the Germans chase him while we escaped our apartment. They took him to Binario 21. "What's that?" Mimo asked. "It's where they take every Jew they catch in Milan.
platform 21 in the central station. They put them into cattle cars, and they disappear, bound for... no one knows. They don't come back.
Tears rolled down her cheek, and her lips quivered with raw emotion. Pino thought about the massacre in Mena, when the Nazis machine-gunned the Jews in the lake. He felt sick and helpless. Your husband, he must have been a brave man. Mrs. Napolitano wept and nodded.
Beyond brave.
After she'd regained her composure, she dabbed a handkerchief to her eyes, and in a hoarse voice said,
Father Ray said you two will take me to Switzerland.
Yes, but with this snow it won't be easy.
Nothing in life worth doing is easy, the violinist said.
Pino looked down at her shoes, low black pumps.
Did you climb up here in those? I wrapped them in pieces of a baby blanket. I still have them.
They won't work, Pino said. Not where we're going.
It's all I have, she said.
We'll find you boots among the boys. What size are you? Mrs. Napolitano told him. By afternoon, Mimo had found a pair and rubbed the leather with a mixture of pine tar and oil to make the boots waterproof. He'd also gotten her wool pants to wear beneath her dress, and an overcoat, and a wool hat and mittens. Here, Father Ray said, handing out white pillow sacks with holes cut out for shoulders and heads. Wear these.
Why?
Mrs. Napolitano asked. The way you are going is exposed in several places. Someone from far down on the valley floor might see your dark clothes, but with these you'll blend into the snow. Accompanying Mrs. Napolitano was the D'Angelo family, Peter and Liza, the parents, and 7-year-old Anthony and his 9-year-old sister, Judith. From Abruzzi, they were physically fit from a lifetime of farming and climbing in the mountains south of Rome. Mrs. Napolitano, however, had spent much of her life indoors and sitting down playing the violin. She said she walked everywhere in Milan, rarely taking the trolley, but Pino could tell from her breathing at Casa Alpina that the climb was going to be an ordeal for her and for him. 3. Rather than dwell on what could go wrong, Pino tried to think of everything he might need. He got an extra 9 meters of rope from Brother Bormio, and had Mimo carry it bandolier style in addition to his pack, ice axe, poles, and skis. Pino added several carabiners to his already heavy pack, another ice axe, crampons, skis, climbing skins, poles, and a handful of pitons. They set out at 2 o'clock a.m. The moon was half full, reflecting just enough light off the snow that they did not need the lantern. The early going could have been hellish, with all of them having to post-hole up the first rise to get to the spine. But the afternoon before, Father Ray had sent out every boy at Casa Alpina to make the 122-meter vertical climb and descent, in effect boot-packing the hill. Despite the chronic pain in his hip, the priest had broken trail most of the way. The result was a beaten-down path that climbed straight up the west flank of the Gropera. It probably saved Mrs. Napolitano's life. Though she carried only her beloved violin in its case, she labored long and hard up that initial slope, stopping often, fighting for air, and shaking her head, before hugging the violin with both hands and going on. During the climb, which took her the better part of an hour, Pino said little, other than to encourage her with phrases like, That's it. You're doing fine. Just a little higher and we can rest for a bit. He sensed that more than that would do no good. This wasn't like the psychological barriers he'd managed to break with the cigar store owner by deflecting his attention. Mrs. Napolitano was simply not in the physical shape necessary to make a climb this demanding. As he followed her up the mountain, he prayed she had enough spirit and will to compensate. Deepening snow and crevasses had made the boulder field in the bowl all the more treacherous. But with Pino's help, the violinist crossed it without incident. When they reached the tail of the razorback spine, however, Mrs. Napolitano began to shake.
"I don't know if I can do this," she said. "I should go back down with your brother. I'm holding the others up."
"You can't stay at Casa Alpina," Pino said. "It's too dangerous for anyone to stay there for long." The violinist said nothing, but then turned, held tight to her stomach, and vomited. "Mrs. Napolitano?" Pino said.
"It's okay," she said. "It passes."
"Are you expecting?" Mrs. D'Angelo said in the darkness.
"A woman can always tell,"
Mrs. Napolitano gasped.
"She's pregnant?"
A leaden weight came down on Pino's shoulders.
"Oh, my God. A baby? What if..." "You should climb for your baby,"
Mrs. D'Angelo said to Mrs. Napolitano.
"You don't want to go back down. You know what that might mean."
"Pino," his brother whispered after a long silence that followed.
"I can take her back, let her get more used to the altitude."
Pino was about to agree, but then Mrs. Napolitano said,
"I'll climb."
"But what happens if the altitude gets to her, and her baby?" Pino forced himself to stop. He could not let fear take control of his brain. Fear had no business here. He had to think, and he had to think clearly. Telling himself that over and over, Pino took the second rope from Mimo and made a loop under Mrs. Napolitano's armpits. Then he clambered up onto the tail of the ridge. With Mimo behind her, Pino pulled, dragging the violinist up onto the spine. It was a tough chore made tougher by the fact that she held her violin case and would not yield it to Mimo. "You're going to have to leave the violin," Pino said as he threw the loop back down.
"Never,"
she said.
"My violin stays with me always."
"Let me carry it then. I'll make room for it in my pack and return it to you when we reach Switzerland." In the moonlight, he could see Mrs. Napolitano struggling with the idea. "I'm going to need you to have free hands and feet where we're going," he said. "If you keep the violin, you'll put your baby's life in danger." After a pause, she handed it to him, saying,
"It's a Stradivarius. It's all I have now."
"I'll take care of it like my father would," he said, strapping the violin case under the flap of his pack. 4. In short order, Pino pulled up the D'Angelo children, who were treating the whole thing as a grand adventure, and then their parents, who were encouraging the idea. As he had with almost every group of refugees, Pino linked them together with rope, with Mrs. Napolitano right behind him, followed by Mrs. D'Angelo, the children, Mr. D'Angelo, and Mimo bringing up the rear. Before they could start up the ridge, the young boy made a whining noise and began bickering at his sister.
"Stop!"
Pino whispered harshly. "No one can hear us up here," Anthony said.
"The mountain can hear us," Pino said firmly.
"And if you're too loud, it will wake up and shift under its blanket and send avalanches that will bury us all."
"Is the mountain a monster?" Anthony asked.
"Like a dragon," Pino said. "So we have to be careful and quiet, because we are climbing up his scaly back."
"Where's his head?"
Judith asked. "Above us," Mimo said. "In the clouds." That seemed to satisfy the children, and the group set out once more. What had taken him less than an hour the last time he'd climbed the hard route took them almost 2. It was 4:30 in the morning when they reached the chimney. Pino could make out the gouge in the nearly vertical mountain face, but he needed more light than the moon's if they were to climb it. He poured water into the carbide lamp and screwed the lid tight to seal the vapors that were rapidly filling the reservoir. After waiting a minute, he loosened the gas valve and hit the striker. On the second try, a thin blue flame burned against a reflecting pan, throwing enough light up the chimney that they could all see the challenge ahead.
"Oh, my God,"
Mrs. Napolitano groaned.
"Oh, my God."
He put his hand on her shoulder. "It's not as bad as it looks."
"It's worse than it looks."
"No, it's not. Back in September, when the rock was bare, it was worse. But see the ice on both sides? The ice has narrowed the chimney, made it more climbable." Pino looked to his brother. "This may take a little time, but I'm going to cut steps. Keep them moving and warm until you hear me whistle that I'm sending down the axes. Then rope up and send Mr. D'Angelo. I'm going to need his strength up there. You'll come up last." For once, Mimo didn't argue about being last. Pino freed himself from the group rope, dropped his pack, and put on crampons. With Mimo's rope coil slung like a bandolier, he picked up his ice axe and Mimo's and said a prayer before he began to climb. His back to the mountain, Pino reminded himself not to look down before he kicked in the blades of his crampons for support, reached overhead, and jabbed the pick points of the axes into the ice flow. With every half meter gained, Pino stopped and carefully chopped out flat spots for the others. It was maddeningly slow work, and the higher he got, the more he was aware of lights coming on, one by one, down in Campo Dolcino. He knew that with binoculars, someone might see the miner's lamp lighting up the inside of the ice chimney, but he felt he had no choice. 40 minutes later, drenched with sweat, Pino reached the balcony. He kept the lamp on long enough to attach a carabiner to a piton he'd driven into the rock the last time he'd climbed this way, and to pass one end of the rope through the carabiner before testing it with his weight. The anchor held. Pino tied the ice axes and his crampons to the rope, whistled, and then lowered them down the chimney. Several minutes later, he heard his brother whistle, and he took the slack out of the rope. Mr. D'Angelo came up onto the balcony 15 minutes later. Together they pulled his son, daughter, and wife up quickly. 5. Pino could hear Mrs. Napolitano moaning with fear even before she entered the icy slot. He lowered the mining lamp down for her to use. The additional light only seemed to deepen the pregnant violinist's terror. Shaking head to toe, she took the ice axes and in crampons, clomped into the chimney. "Right hand first," Mimo said. "Just give it a good whack in there where Pino's leveled things off." Mrs. Napolitano did so, but half-heartedly, and the axe came free before she could get her full weight on it.
"I can't," she said. "I can't."
Mimo said, "Just climb the stairs Pino made, stabbing the axes and the crampons blades in tight, back and forth all the way up."
"But I could slip."
Pino called down the chute. "Not with us holding the rope. And definitely not if you kick those crampons and swing those axes like you mean it, like your violin bow when you play con smania." That last bit, referring to playing with passion, seemed to get through to her, because Mrs. Napolitano slashed up and out with her right axe. From above, Pino heard the pick end drive solidly into the ice. He backed up to join Mr. D'Angelo on the rope, and he had his wife lie on her belly, looking over the edge and down the chute to tell them each time the pregnant violinist was going to shift her weight and climb higher. Whereas the others had come up half meter by half meter, her ascent was measured in centimeters. Almost 4 meters off the ground, Mrs. Napolitano somehow lost her footing, shrieked, and fell. They caught her, and she dangled there, moaning and blubbering, until they could coax her into trying again. 35 nail-biting minutes later, they hauled her up and over onto the balcony. In the wavering light of the miner's lamp, Frost coated her clothes, and icy snot clung to her face, making her look like she'd been through a frozen hell and back.
"I hated that," she said, collapsing. "Every second of it I hated."
"But you're here," Pino said, grinning. "Not many people could have done that, and you did. For your baby." The violinist placed her mittens over her overcoat and belly and closed her eyes. It took another 20 minutes until they could hoist up the packs, tasks made difficult by the poles and skis strapped to the sides, and another 15 minutes for Mimo to come up the chimney.
"That wasn't too bad," Mimo said. "You must have been tortured as a child," Mrs. Napolitano said.
By Pino's watch, it was almost 6 o'clock. Dawn would come soon.
He wanted them off the face of the Gropera before that.
He tied them all back into the rope line, and they started higher. At 6:30, when they should have been seeing the first paling in the eastern sky, it was suddenly darker than it had been the entire ordeal. The moon had vanished. Pino felt the wind shift too, out of the north now, and stronger.
"We have to move faster," he said. "We have a storm coming."
"What?"
Mrs. Napolitano cried.
"Up here?"
"This is where storms happen," Mimo said. "But don't worry. My brother knows the way." Pino did know the way, and for the next hour, as daylight came amid flurrying snow, they made steady progress. The snowfall was good, Pino decided. It would help hide them from all prying eyes. Around 7:30, the storm intensified, and Pino dug out a pair of glacier glasses his father had given him for Christmas, with leather side blinders to keep out the snow.
Dark clouds enveloped the Gropera.
Supercooled by the frozen crag above them, the clouds began to pour snow down on them. Pino fought the urge to panic as he used his ski poles to probe his way forward, intensely aware that the higher they got, the greater the likelihood of a false step. The wind began to swirl, causing whiteouts. The visibility was so low he was almost climbing blind, and it rattled him. Pino was trying to keep faith, but he felt doubt and growing alarm creep into his mind. What if he took the wrong angle on the route, or made a misstep at a crucial time and fell? With his weight, they'd all be going for a neck-breaking ride. He felt the rope tug him to a halt.
"I can't see,"
Judith cried.
"Neither can I," her mother said.
"We'll wait then," Pino said, trying to keep his voice calm. "Turn your backs to the wind." The snow kept falling. Had the wind stayed a steady gale, they never would have made the catwalk. Instead, it gusted and died to almost nothing every few minutes. During those gaps where Pino could make out the route, they fought their way upward until he felt the ridge line level out and narrow. Ahead 15 meters, he could make out the catwalk and the snowy, concave mouths of the avalanche chutes on either side. 6.
"We go one by one here," he said. "See the white little bowls of snow next to the spine? Don't step there. Just put your feet exactly where I do and you'll be fine."
"What's under that snow?"
Mrs. Napolitano asked. Pino didn't want to tell her. Mimo said,
"Air. Lots of it."
"Oh,"
she said.
"Oh."
Pino wanted to smack his brother. "Come on now, Mrs. N," Pino said, trying to sound encouraging. "You've come this far and done worse, and I'll have the other end of the rope." The violinist made a puffing noise, hesitated, and then nodded weakly. Pino untied the group line and knotted it to Mimo's to create one long line. While he worked, he whispered to his brother, "From now on, keep your mouth shut."
"What?"
Mimo said.
"Why?"
"Sometimes the less you know, the better."
"Where I come from, the more you know, the better," Seeing it was fruitless to argue, Pino tied the rope around his waist. He imagined himself a tightrope walker and held the ski poles horizontally to help him balance. Each step